You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast, brought to you by Travel Bag, creating holidays packed full of exciting memories since 1979. The World Cup marches on. England have done the decent thing by keeping it interesting for everyone else at their own expense, and as we speak, India are on course for their fifth win of the World Cup, while not looking that good. I'm Yaz Rana, and today I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of the Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine, Phil Walker. How's it going, Phil?
It's going...
That's it, right. Okay, great.
It's just great to be on the other side of one of these podcasts for once. I can sit back, I don't have to present it, I don't have to worry about what's being said, I don't have to edit it, I don't have to send it away. It's just lovely, yeah. Well, this feels like my day off.
A, you've never edited them, and B, you said something very similar to me last week. It is really good to be back in our oval commentary box.
In our favoured oval.
Or Church's oval commentary box.
The Mark Church commentary box, yeah.
Looking over a sunny oval. And today, for the first time, a man who doesn't need any introduction at all, former Surrey and England all-rounder, Zafar Ansari. Great to have you on.
Thanks, really good to be here.
We'll ask you a bit more about your career in a bit, but just to kick things off, what are you up to these days?
So right now, I'm doing very little. I've just finished my law conversion, and I've been working alongside that for various legal charities. I recently got pupillage at a barrister's chambers, which means now I go through the process of studying to become a barrister and then training on the job. So I have 3 months of doing very little this summer, apart from watching some cricket, reading some books.
And writing some magazine articles for Wisden Cricket Monthly as
Correct.
Well. Yeah, just to clarify, Zafar is joining us for the next few months as one of our columnists. That should be great fun.
You've been watching much of the World Cup?
I would say my watching of it has been very much second order. I've tended to follow people watching the game predominantly, so I haven't necessarily seen...
What does that mean?
So yeah, I haven't seen much of it live myself. I don't have Sky.
The way you said that, I thought you meant like you were watching people watch it on the TV.
No. I'm reading people who've been watching the games. So yeah, I kind of have very few, I think, original thoughts about what's been going on. But yeah, it's been interesting.
Well, great. I don't want to talk about today's game too much. But Phil, we both were observing that India's batting seems a bit light.
Yeah, it's this problematic middle order, isn't it? And with Dhawan's departure, they've moved KL Rahul up to open the batting. He got 40-odd, I think, today against the West Indies. He got 50-odd. Not too long ago as well, but he doesn't massively convince as an opening bat. He was in there at number four initially. They call up Rishabh Pant, who we as English observers revere, and indeed Australian observers do as well. But you were saying earlier, not quite as iconic a figure amongst Indian fans as maybe
yet,
he is over
I think.
Yet.
What we saw of him last summer and what the Aussies saw of him down under
he's,
in
yeah,
the
he's,
test game, I think, excited us. But I'm not sure if he's
only
quite
played
those
five,
levels.
5 ODIs though, right?
Yeah, only, and he's not done that well, but he does have a strike rate of 130, which isn't bad.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, he's perhaps the best young cricketer in the world. That's my feeling. We've run a big feature in the current magazine actually, and he comes out very, very high up in that list of the best young cricketers in the world. We polled a number of people for that as well. He's not yet played in this tournament. Watching what I saw today, when they rather scraped up to 269, I think it was, and they obviously fluffed their lines against Afghanistan in what would have been the mother of all turnarounds if Afghanistan had just got over the line for that one. It's not really clicking at all yet, their batting lineup, but they have such a gun bowling side that they are able to pull these games around. It's looking increasingly likely that they're going to do that against the West Indies as well. What are they going to do down the line? Well, they have to solve the Dhoni conundrum a little bit. You know, he's 37 years old now, and he's not the player that he once was.
We've talked a lot about that before, and whilst I've been the main anti-Dhoni proponent, I would say, though, that that's not their main concern. So, Mohammad Shami batted 8 for them today.
Sure.
Vijay Shankar back 4. How is Vijay Shankar India's number 4 in a World Cup?
Yeah, I mean, that was a surprise when he waddled out to bat at number 4. I mean, he was a work-a-day IPL player, really. He's in his late 20s. He doesn't really have enormous pedigree. And it's surprising when you think of the embarrassment of riches that India have, that they have alighted upon him. Mm. Pandya, that I don't think they fancy Pandya in at 4 unless it's in the last 10. Mm. Jadhav has hardly had a bat in this tournament, but you know, he's a decent player. He took 120 off England in 70 balls a year or two ago, but he looks out of form, in part because he's hardly picked up a bat. They are in some ways hamstrung by the brilliance of their top three because
the others don't get a go.
They are not as well-oiled a machine as we were maybe expecting them to be at the start of the tournament, and the Dhawan thing obviously impacts them. But as I say, their bowling side is frighteningly good, really. You know, Bumrah is a champion. And these two spinners on pitches which are turning more than we were expecting, and we saw it massively again at Old Trafford, albeit on a used pitch, just as we saw it at Edgbaston yesterday in the Pakistan game. The ball is moving off the straight regularly, and it's making for an interesting tournament, and it is balancing India's batting and bowling quite usefully for them at the moment. They are doing enough to get through it, but they are not convincing really with the bat.
For what it's worth, I would open with Pant, move Rahul back to 4, and I just think that looks like a much more solid top 7. They can't really do much about the bowlers.
I would be surprised if Pant doesn't come in, especially if they qualify on the back of this game against the West Indies. They'll have a mouth-watering game against England on Sunday at Edgbaston, and it's going to turn bad on Sunday. Zafar, how do you see this England India game? It's looming, a spectre on the landscape. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to predict. I think England have a decent chance. You know, if you kind of step back away from the troubles of the last couple of games and you look at it more structurally, I think England have lost 2 games and they've got such good players that the chances are that some of those will come off, you know, this third game. Mm-hmm. As you say, India are a very good side, have some very good individuals, but it seems to be a theme of the tournament that, you know, batsmen 6, 7 and 8 aren't producing particularly. And so there will be a time again where their top 3 don't come off. They've managed, one of them at least has managed to score runs in every game. I think Kohli has scored runs almost every match, and there will be again a game where that doesn't happen. And I feel like it could be this one.
There are echoes of Australia actually in how India have gone, that they've relied on their 4 or 5 champions, but it doesn't look like a team that is strong from 1 to 11.
That might, you know, potentially need more than that to win a World Cup, though. If your best 5 players are that good, that can be enough to take you over.
Could I add just one further point? I mean, I'm interested to get your views. The lack of genuine all-rounders, I think, has been quite an interesting aspect of the tournament. I haven't noticed anyone producing equal. I mean, Ben Stokes is probably been the best there. But otherise, I haven't. Again, this is from someone who hasn't
Shaqib
seen a lot of
as well.
And Shaqib, yeah.
Pandya's done well.
Both outright, though, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a fair point. Generally, you thought that as cricket became more and more professional, that you'd have more and more all-rounders. Like, England have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to all-rounders in the test game. But it's a fair point. So yesterday in the New Zealand-Pakistan game, Jimmy Neesham scored 97 out. Great innings. But you would say that Jimmy Neesham at six, and also him being the fifth bowling option, it makes both New Zealand's batting and bowling just a bit light. And I feel pretty much every team is in that position.
Yeah, and you also
bar England.
Also, you mentioned Stokes. He was under-bowled at Lords against Australia, I thought, and has been managed. His bowling quotas have been managed quite severely, really, by England in the last 6 to 12 months. And it's almost as if the expectations on multi-format cricketers and multifaceted cricketers, something has to give within that. I mean, Zafar, you did both disciplines very, very effectively and successfully for Surrey for a number of years. Were you aware of that when you were a player, that one had to cede to the other, in effect?
Yeah, I think it happens naturally. You do ebbs and flows between sort of the different aspects, parts of the game. There were periods where I was a batter who bowled the occasional over, and then I quickly switched from being a bowler who batted down the order. So yeah, you don't necessarily have the control over that you'd want. And I think lots of people strive to be genuine all-rounders, but it's a very difficult thing to do across multiple formats. For a long period.
So when you're an 18-year-old breaking into that Surrey side, you were man of the match here on debut. Did you see yourself more as a batsman?
Yeah, definitely.
It must have been pretty weird making a test debut a few years later batting 10.
Yeah, but it also changed very quickly. I would have said a batsman up to about 18. I then took a 5-wicket haul against Surrey for Cambridge and continued to bowl quite well across the formats and played a particular role in one-day cricket as a batsman. And then eventually I got the opportunity to open, scored a few runs and it flipped around again. So I didn't have much control of it, but yeah, I definitely saw myself more as a batter growing up.
Stokes said that to me a few years ago as well, when he couldn't score a run for Durham one summer, and was running through teams with the ball. And I spoke to him and he said, yeah, but I'm still a batsman who bowls. The stats don't back it up. And some of it is in the mind, isn't it? Some of it is what you tell yourself, how you define yourself as a cricketer doesn't necessarily always tally with those numbers, which can be reflective only of a certain truth at times. You know, we've spoken about that before as well, you know.
Yeah, and I think that is intentional sometimes. Like I would actively say I'm a batter in a way because I knew my bowling was slightly better and it took a bit of pressure off my bowling and vice versa. So you, I think, can control that. You can kind of frame that narrative to yourself and then go from
but
there.
When did you last pick up a bat, Zafar? Just out of interest.
This is interesting. I played one game this summer.
How'd you go?
For a Surrey Masters team. And in terms of whether I'm batter or bowler, I couldn't bat. I honestly faced 10 balls and scored 6 runs and it was horrendous. And then the ball came out very nicely when I was bowling. So right. It was a kind of interesting inverse of that, you know, childhood where I was always felt like I was more of a batter.
Well, you were certainly shadow batting downstairs as we were waiting to get in the lift to come up to the show.
Definitely.
Still in there somewhere.
Yeah. I agree with both you of what you said about the importance of bowlers in the World Cup. But I want to talk about one batsman that Phil really, really likes and he talks about in detail yesterday. Zaf, basically, Phil loves Babar Azam. And he's ever since we started the podcast, is what a 2-minute segment on each episode, basically, on you and Babar Azam. And after his 100 yesterday, the episode starts with 2 minutes of Phil just talking about Babar Azam. I was really annoyed because you didn't mention the stat that I WhatsApped you, a really good stat.
You did.
About
Babar Azam. I didn't want to overdo it. Yes. Okay. I thought 2.5 minutes when I'm basically talking to myself was probably enough.
I genuinely didn't know you were the guest for 2.5 minutes. That was
you thought it was just going to be a monologue. Like an excited Alan Bennett style monologue.
wouldn't put it past you. But that stat is that the most runs scored in a Cricket World Cup by somebody 24 or under is quite an impressive list. So one Sachin in 96, two De Villiers in 2007, three Ponting in 99, four Lara in 92, and five already is Babar Azam in 2019. That is some list to be a part of. And the reason I wanted to bring him up was watching Pakistan's win yesterday, watching Babar's reaction when he scored 100, he just seems to mean so much to the Pakistan players and the fans. Zainab Abbas, who's presenting the World Cup for the ICC digitally, she hosts the Pakistan Super League. She's been in this game for a while and she really knows her stuff. She said that she has never been to a ground with atmosphere like that.
Well, it's one of the few home games that Pakistan play.
Yeah.
In front of a proper crowd. You know, you can't count Abu Dhabi and Dubai and those peculiar sort of desert funeral games that they have to play. And obviously they can't play at home, certainly not international cricket. When they play here, it must feel like playing in downtown Lahore in the best possible sense.
But Babar was quite emotional when he got to his 100.
He was, and he's not, from what I can tell, a particularly demonstrative kind of character, and yet there was a hell of a lot that was let out there. But then when you saw the scale and intensity of the response to the India defeat, which is obviously predicated on disproportionately vast grounds anyway, as we know, and it would have been impossible to avoid it, what would have happened back home as well in Pakistan. And social media is rabid and in your face, however much you want to try and cocoon yourself as a player. They were forced to kind of release various player-based statements after the India game. Please back us. Please support us. When Imran Khan, the two-headed Imran Khan, as great as cricketer ever, and Prime Minister, is personally sending messages via social media about the team over the course of every game that they're playing, it's incomprehensible levels of pressure and expectation. And you would have to be rather an unusual character not to feel that and have that enormous explosion of emotion at the end when you do win one.
And it's contrasting that with England and England fans. So the atmosphere at Lord's for the Australia game was objectively pretty poor. There wasn't
Atmosphere at that game. I liked the atmosphere of that game because it was tense and quiet and there was a hum to it. I think there are different ways to watch games of cricket, and I think the undulating tension of that game was reflected in the way that the crowd watched it. I didn't have a problem with that personally, just as I certainly don't have a problem with it being a cacophonous riot and a din. And I was at Old Trafford for the India-Pakistan game, and it was phenomenal to be a part of that. I think there are different ways to watch games of cricket, and I think sometimes the crowd reflects what's taking place on the pitch and vice versa.
Maybe it was a bit harsh there. But I think what you said about the pressure that's on the Pakistan players, one thing I find fascinating is their stars at the moment are young guys. Babar Azam is 24. He's
and
there.
You mentioned Shadab as well earlier.
He's 20. Shaheen Afridi took the third best figures ever taken in a World Cup by a teenager. He's a teenager, and they're very well aware of the pressure that's on them. And I find it odd to watch that they're in the same tournament as these England guys who are playing a tournament that they're playing for the team that's hosting a tournament in which a country doesn't really know the World Cup's going on, and against them with this Pakistan side, who a World Cup win would be enormous for them.
Yeah, pressure is a weird thing, and it seems like it's the word of the week when it comes to thinking about this World Cup. Definitely playing in front of big crowds, raucous crowds, it takes pressure off a lot of the time. I think as a player, you remember it's a game when you're playing in front of a crowd that's loud and enjoying themselves. I maybe this is hindsight, I don't know. I tended to feel least pressure in front of the biggest crowds here at the Oval on a Friday night,
right,
in front of 25,000 people, because it felt like a game again. It felt like that thing I was doing when I was 12, 13, whatever. It was when I had to turn up here on a Sunday in front of 1,000 people in the pavilion that I felt most pressure. So I think sometimes we use this word pressure and we don't necessarily sort of interrogate it closely. Also, I think there's a lot of pressure. Obviously, politically, there are issues and they seem to impinge on Pakistan's cricket a lot of the time. But being away from that environment, just being in another country, takes some of that burden off, I think. They're not surrounded by necessarily by people calling them into question in the same way that the England players are. And I think that helps, definitely.
England cricketers, there's very little jeopardy for England cricketers. If you lose, sure, people are going to be a bit pissed off. You're going to get the odd reaction on Twitter. there's going to be some op-eds written in the Times the day after what's gone wrong with English cricket. But let's be honest, England cricketers are walking away with, you know, a lot of money in the pocket. They're going to be obviously upset by the result, but they then just pick up the story and they go again. And if you're an England cricketer, then you know that you're going to be comfortable and that there's going to be jobs available for you after you retire and so on and so on and so on. You are not dragging a nation with you. You are not... Effigies are not burnt of England cricketers if they lose an important game of cricket, a so-called important game of cricket. I still find it incomprehensible how players from South Asia are in that astonishing psychological situation on a daily basis, that people are in bits, people are broken-hearted if you miss a straight one and you lose a game of cricket.
Yeah, I mean, I think two things. Firstly, I think it's overestimated how much pressure the England team are feeling at the moment. I think that's talked up. I think that they've lost games because they've played badly. As I said, earlier, I think it's the media that tends to feel the pressure in these situations more than the players. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to analyse what's gone wrong. And really, when they're talking about pressure, they're often reflecting how they're feeling. Mm. But secondly, yeah, I agree that gradient is the distinction between the pressure that England players probably feel playing a normal bilateral series 2 years ago and the pressure that they might feel during a World Cup, which is quite a large gap. Whereas if you're a Pakistani player, maybe you feel that same level of tension every time you step on the field. Therefore, you're more acclimatized, attuned to that.
Just very briefly, on you mentioned the young players coming through. It's great to see, because Pakistan have struggled for batsmen just in recent years. And now, not only Babar, but they have, I think, Imam Al-Haq, although he hasn't really scored big runs in this tournament, he looks like a good player to me. Fakhar Zaman as well, he's a bit of a dasher, but he's got talent. Haris Sahail, I thought, was as good as Baba yesterday, if not better.
Why was he out the side?
Yeah, I know. So he's now made an 89, I think, and a 68 or 9. Back-to-back
very innings, quickly, very he played innings. The shot of the tournament. The uppercut, Rabada into the grandstand, is shot of the tournament.
That was stunning.
Moving on. So on July the 5th, Bangladesh played Pakistan at Lord's, which could be one hell of a game. With a quarterfinal, a semi-final place on the line, I can't wait for that.
And England might be waiting for that result. Is that because it comes after the Chesney Street game?
So if England lose one and win one, that game England will be waiting on the result, hoping that Bangladesh win. That's presuming that Bangladesh lose to India, which you never know in this tournament. England could already be out of the tournament for that game as well, by the way. So lots could happen. I basically wrote the tournament off 2 weeks ago.
we do say a lot of things that sometimes come home to bite us.
Yeah,
I think it's fair to say.
Some big cricket news today. Marcus Shashkothic announced that he retired from professional cricket at the end of the 2019 season. He made his first class debut in 1993. That's before Oasis' debut album Definitely Maybe came out. John Major
Wales was before you were born.
Not that long, but John Major was Prime Minister. He's a proper throwback to a previous generation. I mean, he's a throwback to his own generation, basically. Didn't have the physique of somebody you'd imagine would play professional sport for 26 years. A 2005 Ashes winner. He played ODI cricket in a way that was literally a decade ahead of his peers. Did away with foot movement years before it was cool. a modern day England great.
Yeah, I guess occasionally get asked, like, who was the best batsman that you bowled at, other than Kohli or Root or whoever. And the two people I tend to say in at least in sort of first class cricket were Rob Key and Marcus Shashkothic.
Keezy, you'll be thrilled with that.
No, he was very difficult to bowl at. But yeah, Shashkothic, you know, had the all round game against spin, the all-round game against seam. He was
so. Why was he so hard to bowl at?
Well, he's a big guy.
Just club you over mid-wicket.
So yeah, no, I mean, so he would often, take off stump guard, get his big right foot outside off stump and sweep you. But he was a very adept. He had quick feet for a big guy. He could get down, knock you through.
Good touch for a big man.
Yeah, exactly. So he sort of had the all-round game.
We used to do the cricketers who's who in our office. We used to produce that, and the question would be to every county cricketer who's best cricket you played against. And it would be a straight hit between Ram Prakash and Triscothic year after year after year, pretty much sort of 200 each for those two. Standout cricketer, standout bloke as well, Triscothic. I first came across him in the Cricketer magazine probably about 1990 when I was about nine. And there was a photo of a portly bloke, a portly little lad who was breaking all records in the Somerset Leagues, and he was about 15. And he'd been given a V500 by the magazine because he was breaking all records. And he looked so ungainly.
How do you remember this?
Because it always stuck in my mind for whatever reason. I thought that might be me one day. I don't know what it was. But anyway, I always remember that little black and white photograph in the back of the magazine. And I've actually spoken to him about it. And he's still got that back, he said. He's still got that little Harrow V500. Yeah,
so I think long term, I really hope that he'll also be remembered for being an innovator in the field as well. It's not properly caught on yet, but have you seen videos of him? Yeah, him fielding on his knees at spin. I really hope that continues.
Yeah, personal recollections as we're doing this. Edgbaston day one, 2005. He'd never scored any runs against Australia. He struggled at Lords. McGrath nicked him off twice. He'd not got runs in Australia as well when they toured 2002-03. We'd got beat quite comfortably, as we know, at Lords, and he just ran down the pitch at Warne in that first session. And we were 130 for naught at lunch. And obviously that set up the mother of all games. But it was Triscothic's attitude, I thought, that morning. And we'd never seen an England batting lineup dare to behave like that. Maybe Peterson took the cork off at Lords, possibly, but Strauss and largely Triscothic went after Warne that morning, and it was sensational to watch, and it just set that whole summer up.
I feel like I'm watching the box set all over again.
He was the sort of player that you felt the Australians respected, and that seemed to be almost a marker of whether you were a proper player or not. I mean, there are lots of players, good players, who they didn't probably respect, but he felt like one that the Australians thought, yeah, this is someone we need to get early, otherwise he will hurt us.
Do you have standout memories from that summer? You're still quite young. You would have been young during that 2005 series. You're allowed to say no.
Young, technically, yes. Right, fair enough.
To a lot of people, that's a very formative series.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, I think I have exactly the same memories as everyone else, which are, you know, of watching some of those matches, the Edgbaston game, the Oval match, and just being taken by it, really. It was an important time when I was 14, and you know, you start to have to make decisions about what you're going to pursue, and I think I'm sure it made a difference for me in that decision.
Zaf, you didn't quite do a Triscothic, you packed it in all age 25.
Nice link. Very nice link. Yeah, it's very nice.
You just toured with England. You were a very capable opening batsman, frontline spin bowler across all three formats. Simple question, why do you stop?
I think, you know,
go
talking about
the top.
Well, firstly, like, if you're, yeah, being very capable is sort of indicative of perhaps lacking something more special. And I think that, you know, I was capable, definitely. And, I, you know, I had a good county career, but it wasn't ever going to be Joe Root, Moeen Ali. I think also, you know, talking about Triscothic, knowing people, I don't know him very well. I've just, you know, I just say hello to him. But knowing people who've played with him, they say how much enthusiasm, how much love he's always had for the game, but he continues to have for the game even into his 40s. And I just didn't have that.
Did you ever have that?
I think when it was going well, I really enjoyed the game. And there was a sort of a 3-year period, I'd say, in my career where it went as well as it almost could have gone for me, wickets, runs, and so on. And I really enjoyed that period. But that obviously isn't a good test of whether you really love something. And I don't know if I really loved it enough to definitely want to do it for 15 years. So it was part of it.
I read that you said that watching the hyper competitiveness of Kohli, Stokes, Root, etc., in close quarters when you toured with England made you perhaps realise that playing cricket professionally wasn't for you. Two things. Number one, do you think that if you were Moeen Ali levels of in terms of natural talent, do you think you would have played longer?
I think it would have been a much harder decision to give that up. You know, the other side of it, which I tend to say when people ask why did I stop is that I was restless. I wanted to do something completely different. And that would have existed whether I was Moeen Ali. And I don't know how those two things would have worked out, whether they would have cohered, whether I'd have been able to continue for longer and then go in another direction. But for a while, for a couple of years before I retired, I was looking at other things and thinking, I want to be doing those, or I want to be starting to move in that direction.
Was there a trigger that made you make the final decision?
I mean, I played a terrible innings here against Lancashire.
Right.
Which was effectively the game that I retired after. I got two off about 30 balls. Simon Kerrigan bowled me with a good delivery. But, you know, the feeling of embarrassment when getting out is pervasive. But it felt different that game, walking off, having just batted so badly. So in some ways, I feel like that was probably the trigger, you know, the innings before I stopped. But as I say, I think I'd kind of come to terms with retiring over the previous probably 12 to 18 months. And so the trigger probably would have come at some point, you know, that summer.
Yeah. You're working with the Refugee Council just up the road. You mentioned this to me a few days ago. I've played against Refugee Council, as I told you. The Afghan opening batsman hit Ben Walker, who's now at the ECB, for the biggest six I've literally ever seen. What compelled you to go and help out in this very, very important cause?
Well, it's, I suppose, a continuation of what I've generally been doing for the last couple of years since retiring. So I've been doing the law stuff with the sort of vague intention of becoming a lawyer, trying to become a barrister. But alongside that, I've wanted to actually work in the real world, get to understand and try and deal with issues that I think are important. And I, you know, the Refugee Cricket Project, which I'm just volunteering with, is really nice because it combines, you know, something I do enjoy, which is cricket, with something that I think is important, which is, you know, supporting these people with immigration advice and welfare advice and so on. So it's a really nice mixture for me.
And how to play cricket as well, right? You are involved in the coaching side of this.
Yeah, predominantly I'm just basically throwing balls at young.
Watching them fly over your head.
Yeah, and I suppose, yeah, realizing or appreciating how much value the sport has as a positive activity for particular groups of people at particular times.
Obviously, your attitude towards cricket is different to most cricketers by the fact you retired when you were 25. When you were playing county cricket, this is before you got the England call-up, was playing for England the ultimate goal?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I was always aware that it would be, you know, an incredible honour, something that would be an amazing experience, definitely. But I think, and I don't think this is unique necessarily, I think that a lot of county cricketers really are focused on doing their job well. And that's kind of a trite thing to say, but really they are. I think I never felt, or for quite a lot of my career, which wasn't that long, but, you know, for the first 3 or 4 years, definitely, I didn't feel comfortable as a county cricketer. I thought, you know, that imposter syndrome type thing. Am I good enough to be even a professional cricketer? And so I didn't really ever think about England. I just wanted to sort of average 40 with the bat and take, you know, 25, 30 wickets in championship cricket. And that was my aim.
You've played, how long was your career in the end? Six years?
Six and a half years, yeah.
Do you think that there are cricketers out there who are underwhelmed by the game, struggling with the game, not enjoying the game, but feel, in effect, trapped inside it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I think a lot of cricketers enjoy the sport and get a lot out of it, but feel like it's the sort of thing they would love to do for a chunk of time and move on to something else. But because of the way that, you know, the sport is professionalized and the amount of commitment that you have to show at a young age, you do potentially get trapped in it, and it does become something that you can't necessarily escape, or that you don't want to escape, because you're being paid well, because your identity is bound up with it.
Do you feel how did it feel knowing that you were slightly different in terms of your priorities to a lot of the other players in your dressing room? Like you shared a dressing room, you're similar to someone like Jason Roy, two quite different characters, and you're in a sorry dressing room that has gone on to do really, really impressive things. What was that like, being different? Were they very accommodating of you? Was that a known thing that you had different priorities?
Yeah, everyone was very accommodating. I'd grown up with all these guys, so it wasn't sort of a random thing that happened when I was 18 or 19. We knew each other very well. I would say that my priorities weren't necessarily that different when I was playing. I think the difference, at the time I probably did talk about having a degree of perspective because of an interest in other things and so on. I'm not sure if that was the case. I think, in fact, practically the difference was that I just materially had an alternative, like a very clear alternative, potentially, which was, a professional job based on the fact that I had a good degree. And I think that that alternative existed and was helpful, because it meant that at the point that I really didn't want to play cricket anymore, I had somewhere to go. But on a day-to-day basis, in terms of how I felt, my priorities weren't necessarily different. Maybe different politics, maybe different kind of... I would do different things with my free time, but I don't know if how I actually felt was particularly different.
I read that an interview you did with The Guardian a couple of years ago. You were describing being in the England dressing room when Donald Trump was elected US president. So I remember that really clearly, because that was the game that Haseeb Amin made his test debut. And I was covering the US election night as part of a student university paper. And I had to go to the university US election party. And I was watching Haseeb Amin open the batting on my phone whilst supposedly covering it.
You were always going to come and join us in the end.
You said that it was a very politically significant time. Trump was elected on the first day of our opening test in India. You were batting 10. You weren't allowed phones in the dressing room, and you were getting little snippets of information from security, but you felt disconnected to something that you are interested in. What were the other players' reaction? Did they care that Trump was elected?
Yeah, they found it interesting. I think we had conversations during the trip about Trump, the significance of Trump. But the nature of Donald Trump, I suppose, is his skill is to present himself as this figure of entertainment. And I think that was mainly how he was viewed within the team to some extent. I mean, they were aware of some of the shocking things he had said, but inevitably, if you're not following it particularly closely, Donald Trump is the presenter of The Apprentice. It's a different version of Trump. And I suppose that I was following it as closely as I could, and therefore was aware of this sort of nationalist, isolationist kind of approach that he was taking, very right wing. And I found that, quite troubling.
Here.
Elsewhere in the world, it's been a really good week for Phil. Actually, not only did Babrazam score his 100, Nicholas Pooran is going to play for Yorkshire.
Yes, I gathered this. Yeah, great news. He's just a dreamboat, isn't he, Pooran? He didn't get any today. In fact, he rather typifies the West Indies World Cup campaign, really. Pooran and Hetmyer, flattered to deceive. We did say right at the start, actually, of this tournament, one of the few things that we've been vaguely correct about, that middle order of the West Indies has just been a bit too fallow at this stage.
It's the one thing we've got right.
Yeah. But they are two fine players, obviously, and they will provide the backbone of what looks like an interesting team down the line. So, yeah, it's good. And it's another, because Babar, of course, is playing county cricket as well. So it's two very high class young players.
That'd be five games for Yorkshire.
Yeah.
There was something else that I wanted to ask both of you. And I think, Zafi, I think you might have an interesting perspective on this. So there was a study released this week that said that 43% of England's male test team, or was it the World Cup squad? Can't remember which one it was. Basically, 43% of the England team or England squad are privately educated, which is more than rugby, and it's one of the highest percentage of any profession in the country. Cricket's obviously got a long way to go in terms of diversifying itself. I don't really have a question, but as somebody who play the game, and you went to Hampton School, so privately educated. What can cricket do? It's basically the least diverse sport in that respect. Which is quite depressing, right? If you like a game, you want more people to play it. And if you hear stats like that, that's suggesting that not that many people are playing it.
It's really depressing. You know, I think that there are obvious things to do which are uncomfortable, but perhaps going back to free-to-air TV, those sorts of things broaden the game and perhaps encourage a wider array of people to get involved. Obviously, the mismatch between British Asians who play the game and British Asians who then play professionally is part of that problem, because the majority of British Asians are going to be going to state schools, as are the majority of the country. I think it's obviously a massive issue, but it's obviously also a reflection of broader problems with equality within society, and it almost feels as if trying to solve the issue in cricket without thinking about it more broadly is perhaps missing something.
Something you said before we went on air that I thought was quite interesting, because it's something that I've thought for a while, is that you were talking about cricketers' pay. And without getting into the specifics of numbers, I've always felt that cricketers do actually get paid quite a lot of money. If you're an England player, if you're in the England World Cup squad, you get paid loads of money. Even if you're a county player, for a 21-year-old playing at Northants Worcester, you're actually on, compared to what your peers will be on, a lot of money, and you're doing something that you enjoy. Is there an awareness of that in cricketing circles, that players do earn a lot of money for the average person? Because all you ever really hear is, oh, they earn not compared to footballers, they earn anything, which is true, but they are still earning way more than the average punter.
Yeah, I think that the issue is, because you look at football and you see the mismatch between that and cricket, it's easy for cricketers to say, well, you know, we're actually working harder than footballers. We're putting in more time. Why are we not getting paid more? But I don't know if there's an awareness of just how well paid cricketers are, but it is. It's extreme, really, especially at the top of the game. And I think that is something that, it's a fact. I'm not sure if that's something that needs to change in order to encourage more people to play the game or not, or whether the fact that so much money goes to the top of the game means that the development of the grassroots is somewhat restricted. I have no idea, but that seems a possibility.
Did you make your debut at Rajkot?
I played. It was my second game. I played against Bangladesh first.
Okay. Yeah. I wrote about this for the Almanac, two or three years ago now. The question of social mobility in cricket. Of that top seven in the Rajkot Test match, Moeen Ali grew up in Sparkill in Birmingham in a council estate. Went to a school with 40% free school meals. And Ben Stokes grew up via Christchurch in New Zealand, of course, son of a nine-fingered rugby league player. He grew up in Cumbria and went to Cockermouth School. Of the top seven, they were the only two that didn't go to a private school. Hamid went to Bolton School on a scholarship. And the ECB released a statement soon after this social mobility study, and it was 43% of county cricketers. It wasn't just of the England side. And they released a statement hastily on the back of it, trumpeting the scholarship scheme, which is undoubtedly a fair point up to a point, I think. And by a certain measure, it's true. Joe Root, for example, went to Worksop College via a scholarship. Hamid, as I said, various others as well. Many others, in fact. But it doesn't sit entirely comfortably with me either, because while it's useful, it's great for the individual and it rewards an individual's aspirations, what about all of the others? What about all of the others who have no reason other than just another excuse just to kick a football around, because there's no cricket in their state school? The only beacon of inspiration, a Joe Root at 12, has been parachuted out of that school and moved to a school with 14 cricket pitches. And it just further illustrates the dividing line, I think, between the haves and the have-nots. And so there is no sense of of fairness at all, I think, in this issue. Now, people will say, well, this is life, so shrug your shoulders. And I actually spoke to Alex Stewart about this, and I asked him the question because I think the last four England debutants, this was last year, had all gone to private school or public school, whatever we call it in this country. Always bizarre, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Anyway, the last four had all gone to fee-paying schools. And I said to the gaffer, who, of course, oversees the intake across leafy Surrey, but also inner London as well, I said, should we be concerned by this? And he didn't understand the question. He thought we should be celebrating this fact because in his mind, and his job is to produce really good cricketers, they are getting great facilities, great services, great facilities, and we should be celebrating the fact that young cricketers, whether they come from a well-heeled background or whether it's scholarships, are given the best possible chance to become top quality cricketers. And there wasn't any consideration for that whole swathe of young people who aren't getting even close.
Going back to what I said earlier when I slagged off the atmosphere at Lord's, I think what I actually kind of meant was that the average member of the crowd did not look like an average member of the public. You know, people were dressed in suits. They looked far more affluent than the average person in the street.
Yep.
And part of the reason why this World Cup is increasingly, disillusioned probably is the right word about the World Cup, is because I was really excited about it. I was really hoping that this World Cup would engage new fans, but it just hasn't.
Like, it still exists in this silo, doesn't it?
Exactly. And what's the point? Genuinely, what's the point? I know we can enjoy cricket for what it is, but when you see fans of Pakistan,
fans of India,
fans of Sri Lanka, they care so much. It is like, well, look, if you show cricket to a wider population, they can really love it. Why can't we do the same?
Well, how do you see this, Zafar? Do you think that cricket is too smug, too comfortable in its own skin?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've written one thing about cricket basically since I retired, and it was an exchange with Mike Selvey about the death of Test cricket. You know, I come to that thinking Test cricket is the ultimate form of the game and is the true test of a cricketer and so on. But really, I think my argument was a kind of sociological one, which is that Test cricket, and perhaps it was an optimistic one in some ways, in that for cricket to expand and to get beyond itself, its kind of posh middle class constraints, it might have to break away from the model that has existed for a long time, and really that might be part of the process. I say that. On the other hand, I've just read Beyond a Boundary, mm-hmm. In which C.L.R. James talks about the value of cricket and, by implication, Test cricket, given that it was written in 1963 for, you know, Trinidad and for the community that he grew up in. So it's not one sided. It's not straightforward. But then I think that there is a comfort with cricket amongst a particular group of people. I get recognised basically by very few people, and the only people I get recognised by publicly come from a particular background. Sure. And that's very obvious to me because they make it obvious to me. But it's a difficult, complicated question, but yeah.
Zaf, thank you so much for coming on. That's definitely been, honestly, from my perspective, the most interesting podcast we've done. Phil, thanks for coming on.
I'm always here for you, yes.
And you're back tomorrow, aren't you?
I'm back tomorrow with Vish Vidushan and Hansaraja, who's had a very good World Cup, it's got to be said. We'll be picking apart the Sri Lanka South Africa
game. Why are you laughing?
Because it's rather down the pipe, isn't it?
They could.
Let's get behind the Sri Lankans, eh? Yeah, we might be diverting one or two conversations tomorrow evening.
Wonderful. I look forward to listening to it.
Thank you, Zafar.
Thanks for having me.
This has been the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast, brought to you by Travelbag, creating holidays packed full of exciting memories since 1979. If you haven't already, folks, subscribe. Just a quick message on how you listen to the podcast. I think Spotify is the best place to listen to it. It comes quickly. iTunes and the podcast app can be a bit slow. So I reckon listen to us on Spotify.
Definitely.
Cheers, folks.
Social Podcast Network.